Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on AXA Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to American Spine Then and Now, which includes Andrew Basevich, Stephen Kinzer, Evan Thomas, and is moderated by Brian Bender.
I'd just like to ask the panel what they think of Snowden.
Thomas.
I think he's a traitor who did a public service.
Kinzer.
My sense is that before deciding on Snowden, we need to know if it's really true, as we're being told in Washington, that information he has or has released has had a very serious effect affecting American lives and the lives of people around the world. We haven't seen any real evidence of that. On the surface, I'd like to see some kind of a plea deal reached that would allow him to come home, but that would require full airing of what he did, and I don't think we've had that yet.
Basevich.
I think I'm in the middle. I mean, I wouldn't call him a traitor, but he is somebody who broke the law, and that's not something to be treated lightly. That said, I do believe that in breaking the law, whether it was his intention or not, whatever his intention was, he has indeed performed an important public service.
My name's O'Keefe. I'm on the faculty at Boston College, a provincial little school just outside of town. I heard the story about the guy who was tried, convicted, and never really served any time and still has his job. I'm very curious, what would happen to Mr. Snowden if he voluntarily came back home to the United States of America? Just give me your own cut, your own idea on what you think would happen to him. I'm not asking you how you feel about him, but what would you think would happen to him?
Basevich.
He'll be arrested.
Kinzer.
And he'll serve a long time in very unpleasant prison with no internet access.
Thomas.
I think there would be a huge debate on whether it would be a public trial or not. I think the government would want it to not be a public trial.
He has a big gray mail defense, as they say in the old days. He has in his defense, he can threaten to put out all sorts of secrets that would make the... This is a problem when you prosecute spies who have betrayed you. They can do you a lot of damage in public, in an open court.
I'd be very surprised if he came willingly back to the United States.
Yes, I'm David Kaiser, a historian. I just have a quick comment. A lot of these things have to do with how we see our place in the world. Going back to the beginning of the story, as we did in the late 40s when the CIA was created, it's clear they expected general war with the Soviet Union quite soon. They grew out of the OSS, which had run guerrilla movements against the Axis. And in fact, one of the first things they did was to start setting up networks to run guerrillas within the Soviet Union, in the Baltic states, and I think also Ukraine. And they got a number of people killed that way. So that was one thing that got this off the ground, that we were still in the same kind of war footing we'd been in the Second World War. Now, jumping to the present, it seems to me our frame of mind is in some ways at least as dangerous and is the real source of a lot of what we've been talking about. In that, for one thing, we have arrogated ourselves the right to deal decisively with anybody we think is a bad guy anywhere in the world, summarily and decisively, with no respect for anybody else's national sovereignty. And secondly, in the wake of the end of the Cold War, it seems to me our foreign policy establishment has really convinced itself that no regime that we disapprove of should be allowed to exist or should be able to carry out acts that we do not agree with. And we are facing our first jolt of reality with the annexation of Crimea by President Putin, about which we talk of as something that just shouldn't happen because we think it's wrong, and yet there's nothing we can do about it. But
you have a question?
Yeah, well, just a comment. I do think that by arrogating ourselves this, it is this view of the world and of our role in it that has led to all the abuses that have been discussed, particularly overseas.
Well, is there an alternative in your view of America's view of itself in the world that is better, more appropriate than what we see today, if what David says is correct? that we must remove any bad actors who we think are...
Basevich.
Well, this gets to the original sin, and the original sin is this conviction that we have collectively that we are God's new chosen people, and as God's new chosen people, we therefore are called upon to perform certain functions, and we are relieved of any responsibility to adhere to rules that other people are supposed to follow. And the impact of 9/11, notably on George W. Bush, was to revive in a very strident form this conviction of our chosenness and our specialness. I think that that's deeply pernicious, but it's real. So, yeah, we should begin to think of ourselves as a nation like any other nation. Guess what? It ain't going to happen. David Kaiser, by the way, has a new book out. I just got it in the mail today. It looks very interesting on how Franklin Roosevelt prepared the United States for entry into World War II. Check it out. Kaiser with a K.
Thank you, ma'am.
This was very instructive tonight about the past, but I'm disappointed. Mr. Kistner has mentioned that we are complicit, we the people. I'm disappointed that we haven't discussed or brought to the table how we, the people, can do something about this policy. I've talked to people lately about public affairs, and we've all felt the American people are sheep. So you have pointed out tonight that they're afraid, and that we don't know what's going on, and I blame the media for that, partially, of course. But I would like you to talk a little bit, if you have a little bit more time, about what we can do if we don't agree with the NSA's methods and lack of following the law, which I believe the government is not following the law.
Basevich.
Well, elect different people to make policies. And of course, that's a big challenge because we're stuck with two parties, and both of those parties, in my judgment, are corrupt. Not corrupt in the sense that everybody's on the take, but corrupt in the sense that they're not loyal to the ideals that they actually profess. This becomes an enormous barrier to bringing about any change. And I have no good ideas.
Ginsburg.
One subset of that is that the political structure in the United States, through the collusion of the two parties, has assured that there's no real competition for most of the seats in Congress. The role of money in politics is a very important factor here. It's very difficult for ordinary people to have their views expressed. My friend Seymour Hersh used to get this question a lot. At the end of his speech, somebody would come up and say, "Oh, I agree with you. It's so awful what's happening. What can we do?" And he used to like to lean into the microphone and say, "Nothing." I don't like to say that. Nonetheless, I think there's a very powerful set of institutions that root our current system. Just take one example. We've got up in Lynn the General Electric plant. There's thousands of people working there. One of the projects they're working on is one of the engines for this F-35 fighter plane. Now, the Pentagon couldn't decide which company should build the engine, so they gave the contract to two companies, even though that's twice as much work as is needed. What if you were the congressman from Lynn? Could you get up and say, "This is crazy. This is wasting money. We should only have one company building it. We shouldn't have two." And then risk that you're going to have thousands of people out of work in Lynn? It is so cleverly pernicious of the defense industry that as soon as they get a big contract, they divide it up into pieces and put each piece in the district of some influential congressman, thereby putting that person, even if he's very well oriented and well-intentioned, in very difficult position. And that's one of the things that helps cement this system.
Thomas.
That's true of congressmen, certainly, and always has been. But presidents and people wishing to be president are less willing than they used to be to ask something of voters. I mean, Kennedy's the obvious topical. Ask not, you know. I mean, he's been blamed for getting us into Vietnam with that kind of thinking. It was too expansive. But I'm really struck as I read about the 1950s and 60s that Eisenhower and Kennedy would use the word sacrifice. You can see it in their speeches. They actually use the word sacrifice. Americans are going to have to sacrifice in order to fight the world's fight, to fight against communism, to cure poverty, whatever. They are asking voters to do something, to give up something. And modern political rhetoric makes that impermissible. Modern politicians are not allowed, are banned by their consultants, a class that is, I think, not helpful, from ever asking you to give up anything.
Basevich.
Well, the contrast of the post 9/11 response is striking here, where President Bush, for all kinds of reasons, basically said, y'all don't worry, just live your life. We got the war. We'll take care of
Go shopping.
Go shopping.
Shop. Your duty is to shop.
We're gonna cut your taxes. The American way of life will not be affected as we embark upon an open-ended global war. That's not what John Kennedy said. That's not what David Franklin Roosevelt said on the eve of World War II. So there has been. But again, back to Stephen's point that it's in a sense our fault. Why do we indulge this nonsense? Why do we take it seriously? I mean, and I think the answer is because there's a larger game in which we are all, not we all, many of us are invested, and we don't want to risk any sort of change that's going to upset an apple cart that we may be comfortable with, even if it doesn't serve the long-range purposes of the country and certainly doesn't serve the common good to allow this arrangement to be perpetuated.
Maybe over on this side?
Yes. From looking around the room here, I gather that most of us remember the ads in the newspapers about being able to buy plans for a nuclear bomb shelter to build in your backyard. With that thought in mind, the paranoia in the 1950s about nuclear war, certainly that affected Eisenhower and the Dulleses. With regard to the U-2 incident, that left a bad taste in many people's minds, but in fact, Eisenhower gained an invaluable amount of information about the Soviet Union and its capacities to engage in nuclear warfare and to build nuclear submarines, and I'd like you to comment on that specific topic, issue.
Thomas.
U-2 was one of the greatest government programs ever. Funny, it came in under budget.
Still flying.
It gave us the capacity to... The problem often in intelligence is that you think the enemy is stronger than he actually is. There's a natural bias, a planner's dummy, that planners... It's safer to overestimate the threat than underestimate. You get in less trouble when it all goes wrong. And there was a natural tendency in the 1950s in particular to overestimate the Soviet threat. There was this, remember the missile gap and the bomber gap? They were fictions. We know they were fictions because the U-2 spy plane flew overhead and was able to look down and see that there were not Soviet ICBMs or bombers. We actually had a whole lot more bombers and ICBMs than they have. So the U-2 is fantastically useful as a stabilizing instrument. It kept us from fearing the enemy too much. We still exaggerated the Soviet threat, notwithstanding the U-2 and Soviet satellites, and satellites, but it would have been worse without the U-2.
Ginzer.
Nonetheless, it did destroy any chance in the late 1950s for any rapprochement between Eisenhower and Khrushchev, because we lost one of them. And then Eisenhower got caught in a terrible lie promoted by Alan Dulles. He was supposed to say that this was just a weather plane, and it had gone off track and gone hundreds of miles into the Soviet Union after the pilot had blacked out from lack of oxygen. Khrushchev had secretly already knew that they'd captured the pilot alive, but he'd never announced this. And after the statements came out of Washington, he had a great line. He said, "All the world knows that Alan Dulles is no weatherman."
Well,
Basevich.
But I think the episode illustrates another point. It is by all reports, not that I've ever flown one, a marvelous aircraft, a marvelous machine. It did enable President Eisenhower to gauge relatively accurately Soviet nuclear strike capabilities, and therefore to be assured that we were secure. We didn't have to worry about some overwhelming attack. But because Eisenhower didn't disclose the program, needed to keep the secret, in the context of the time, he knew there was no missile gap, but people like John Kennedy could exploit the mood of the moment.
That's true.
And claim that there was a missile gap with some very considerable political effect. And the point here is that, you know, intelligence is one thing, having the facts is one thing, but we could cite any number of examples where, the facts be damned, It's the temper of the times that determines which facts to take seriously, which to discount, which to dismiss altogether.
Thomas.
It's a slam dunk. Remember that?
Yes, slam dunk. That's right.
This raises an interesting point. I might ask, I ask a lot of questions. I'll let the audience ask one more.
I first want to thank Mr. Kinzer for writing Bitter Fruit. I read it at a very seminal moment developing my career, and it definitely helped shape a lot of the work I try to do and views I have towards foreign policy. Now, generally for everybody, I'm curious as to your thoughts about a lot of these private corporations, whether it be Google or Facebook, that we input so much data into them, and the fact that they have this data, and not necessarily that they share it with the government, but they have it, and they can create profiles based on your interests. One of the best examples is that the Android phone, which I do use, whenever you use it, Google is able to save all the metadata for just what you do throughout your day. So just some of your general thoughts, whether this is a very insidious thing, whether this is something we can do anything about, considering how much these technologies have ingrained themselves into our forms of communications.
Kinzer.
If you don't want people to know stuff, don't use those machines. You go back to the post office. But as Andy said, that's probably not going to happen. We're bringing this all on ourselves. We're giving them the information, then we're complaining that they're taking it.
All right.
Have you read the novel? Read the novel The Circle if you want a good scare.
Got it. Thank you.
Before we get to the last couple questions, I do have a question. In the context of the U2 example of a success, an intelligence success, gathered the information that they set out to gather, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't ask the panel their views on whether, even if you think the intelligence effort of today is overkill, is it protecting us? In other words, is it protecting us? There has not been a 9/11 style attack since 9/11. We've obviously killed a lot of high-value targets with drones, engaged in two wars that were a whole lot longer than anybody anticipated. But even with the overkill, can we feel as Americans that it is accomplishing some good end, which is to protect us from further attacks?
Kinzer.
My feeling is that we are giving up long-term security for short-term feel-good. It's difficult when a president has to make a decision about some terrible thing that's about to happen, if he said, or might be about to happen. You've got to kill these few people. And someone might say to him, you know, don't do that, because in the future, each one of those people is coming from a family and a clan and a tribe, and they're going to swear to kill Americans sometime before the little children die 50 years from now. He can't afford to think about that. Americans are very short-term oriented. We like to do things that make us feel good right now. And if that's going to have a long-term effect, people aren't interested, because you lose the interest of Americans when you use that phrase, long-term. And until we can break out of that mentality, which is kind of comes with the shortness of our national experience, I don't think this is going to change.
You guys have a quick...
Base of itch.
Yeah, I think you have to evaluate costs and consequences, or factor those into any evaluation of whether or not what's being done is effective or not. You touched on some of the consequences. I think you know, there are others that we'll have to see how they pan out. We assert the prerogative of basically sending our drones or our special operations forces wherever we choose to send them to go kill somebody that our president says needs to be killed. Where are we when other nations begin to assert that same prerogative? I mean, what path are we then headed down with regard to the larger question of the norms that should pertain, leading to some definition of international security? Remains to be seen, but I myself am exceedingly uncomfortable. Were I the guy in charge in Beijing, I'd be sort of making a note saying, well, someday we can use that method, and it's going to be hell to pay when that happens.
Yeah. I'm Judy Pollack. I'm an American citizen. My question is really, when 9/11 happened, that was an attack on the United States. After 9/11 happened, it was really incredible to me that none of our bridges blew up, like the George Washington Bridge, either from below or above. A car could certainly come off any of the bridges, go on to any of the bridges, with explosives in the trunk. I had spoken to someone, and they said that we were using, like, submarines, robotic submarines to check the bridges and make sure they were safe. I'm wondering which agency or who was protecting our interests here in the United States. And my other comment, different, but what you talked about, you said that at times we have sacrificed as citizens, but I don't see Congress sacrificing anything, including health care, that and living the same standards and yet representing us. Thank you.
Protecting the bridges?
Basevich.
Well, I mean, on the first question, there were a variety of agencies already in existence at 9/11, and the response to 9/11 was to consolidate them into something called the Department of Homeland Security, add some additional pieces like the Transportation Safety Agency, is that it? TSA?
Security.
And that is the Department of Homeland Security protects the homeland. The Department of Defense basically doesn't. The Department of Defense is the instrument for projecting American power abroad. And I think one of the themes of our remarks is to invite people to think about whether or not that projection of American power abroad has, on balance, positive consequences or negative ones.
However, I also brought up the question of, well, the fact...
We still have a couple more questioners that I would like to get to before we
It relates to the first statement I made.
Quickly.
Okay.
Very quickly.
What prevented a car from having explosives in the trunk and going over your major bridges?
Nothing.
Nobody did it. Or if they did try, as some did, they got caught before it happened. Let's go to our last two questions. Gentleman over here, and then we'll go there.
I've been waiting for a while.
Oh, okay. It's too high. Hi, my name is Robin Clemens. My question is, do you think that our foreign policy is setting us up for retribution vis-a-vis, like, these young, you know, men, like the marathon bombing, things like that, terrorism, you know, random incidents of terrorism, like at airports? And do you think that our foreign policy is having this come back, you know, to haunt us via these isolated incidents? But do you think that that'll happen even more in the future? And my other question is...
Can we just keep it to one? Because we really are about to run out of time.
Tamerlan Tsarnaev, do you... Yeah, my other... It's kind of a two-part. Tamerlan Tsarnaev, was he at all investigated by the FBI, CIA, anything ahead of time? Do you think they knew anything ahead of time about his radicalization? Thank you.
Blowback.
My first...
Ginzer.
If the answer to your first question is no. I don't believe that... we can think there won't be any of this blowback. There will be. It will happen. It's starting to happen, and it will get more intense. As for Tsarnaev, I think we realize a lot of strands weren't put together. Whether there's more out there, I hope we find out when there's a trial.
Thomas.
Well, one of the good things about studying history and writing history is that however bad things seem right now, they look pretty bad then, too. And, you know, we always talk about these golden eras and how great it was. Well, if you go back and read in the 90s, pick a year, you know, all hell, it always looks like the roof is about to fall in, that blowback is coming upon us, that our enemies are going to get us. You know, that's just the way we're acculturated to fear what's right around the corner. But the long history of the United States has been pretty positive. We've oppressed a lot of people, and we've made a lot of mistakes, and we've gotten in some stupid wars, and we've gotten people unnecessarily killed. But... on the great scheme of world history, we are less likely to abuse power than other regimes. We've done it, but we're less likely to do it. The arc of our history has been upward.
Our last question.
All right, gentlemen. Am I close enough? Gentlemen, thank you for your time this evening, first off. Second off, the Geneva Convention, correct me if I'm wrong, says that while it states that you have to treat soldiers in certain ways, it says that if you catch a spy within your... Within your service, there is no... The Geneva Convention says you're allowed to do whatever you want with them. As is the case, we have intelligence communities that rely more on simply not being caught, as is the nature of covert affairs. So my question is, how do you regulate... how do you, A, monitor, and B, regulate and define what is acceptable behavior for an entity whose entire philosophy in order to function is it doesn't matter what you do so long as you don't get caught?
Basevich.
Well, I mean, I guess I don't agree with your premise. I mean, I do not believe that what intelligence agencies do doesn't matter if they don't get caught. And that there are laws and regulations and directives that apply. The hard part is A, drafting the right laws, and B, probably harder still, making sure that they are followed, enforced, because the nature of the activity is, you know, in secret, and therefore oversight supervision come to be very challenging. But I don't think I'd simply disregard the possibility of actual oversight being in place.
Ginzer.
I think there's an automatic impulse in security agencies to feel, well, we need to obey the law, we have certain rules, we have certain structures we have to operate within, but there are certain moments when we're under terrible threats and we can't be bothered by legal niceties at those very stressful moments. And when those moments come is, of course, up to the discretion of people who are outside of our purview and outside of our ability to influence. So legality serves a nice function, but I think there's always an impulse inside the security apparatus to think that there are moments when legality has to be put aside.
Thomas.
That's true, but it has also been a self-correcting mechanism. There are terrible moments. We get frightened. We round up all the Japanese and put them into concentration camps. We commit genocide on the American Indians. We've done all these terrible things in our history. But American history is full of many examples of the rule of law reasserting itself. It gets battered, but then it comes staggering back up because of a vigorous press, because our court system, compared to the rest of the world, is we really do have a rule of law in this country. It has a way of reasserting itself and saving us, if you will, from ourselves, not always and at all times, but eventually. That's all, folks.